Hi, and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is episode 82. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK police force. Welcome, if this is your first time, and if it is, I'd suggest perhaps going back to episode 1 and starting at the beginning, and welcome back if you've been here before. This is actually about the third time I've tried to record the episode this week. It's been quite difficult. I've been travelling again in the motorhome. I tried to do it on the ferry yesterday. The engines were too loud. Fortunately, the motorhome, very restrictive where you park in terms of either car noise or if it starts raining. Unfortunately, I tried earlier and got about 4 minutes in. It started pouring the rain, so I had to stop it. It is spitting at the moment, so I'm hoping we're going to get through this and we'll see how it goes. So no real theme this week, particularly one incident. We're going to talk about a few things, and we'll see how we get on for time. Thanks for downloads this week, and also thanks for buying me a coffee. Had a couple of those, so thank you. A little bit of background car noise here, I'm afraid, out of my control. So hopefully it won't be too off-putting for you. Had a couple of comments on YouTube as well this week about mental health, which I'll try and cover a little bit later, or at some point I will. I think I've covered some of those things before, but I'll try and cover them in maybe in a bit more detail, and it ties in with some of the things we're going to talk about today. So one of the things we're going to talk about is large events. Now we have talked about them before, but the one particularly in mind is going to be COP26. Now this was a large environmental event that happened in Glasgow, and it happens every year, and it moves around Europe, if not the world, I think, talking about environmental issues. But from a policing point of view, it requires a huge amount of resources. And certainly, even for the UK, you know, quite a well-policed country one way or another. And the fact that it was in Glasgow, it required, you know, sort of people from all over the country. There's no way Police Scotland could cover it themselves. If it went into London, the Met couldn't cover it either. You know, it has to have mutual aid, assistance from other forces. For example, COP26 used officers who were flying drones, you know, from Devon and Cornwall and things. So it really was very much a UK event. The planning went on for 2 or 3 years in the lead up to it, and various officers were sort of taken off other duties and moved across to actually help plan the event. And certainly come the sort of 2 weeks that it ran for, the issues were that frontline officers had to go off and sort of police this COP26, so they had to be backfilled. So lots of dusty old cops who sort of normally flew desks, you know, sat behind desks, were drafted in to help on the frontline policing, and I was one of those. I'd actually moved on to another role. I'd been about a year in another role that I'd had, but I was asked to come forward and go back onto response for those, I think it was a 2 or maybe a 3 week period while COP26 was on, to help out on the frontline policing. And to be honest with you, it wasn't a huge leap for me. You know, I've been on response a number of times in my career, as you will have heard if you followed the series. So it didn't really bother me too much. But some of the cops that were sort of back out on frontline, you know, had 20 years, you know, since they'd put a uniform on. And things change a lot in the police in that time. The actual policing doesn't change of how you deal with people, but in terms of the paperwork and what you can and can't do maybe change. So some of them had a bit of a shock, I think. So I was asked to cover response. So we'll deal a little bit with backfilling, as we'd call it, which is what I was doing, and we'll deal with some other events. Another large event that happened during my time in the police was in Glen Eagles. 2005 was the G8, and that's a meeting, I believe, of the heads of state, and they discuss, I don't know, whatever heads of state discuss. But again, another huge event for Scotland, so that needed mutual aid. And at the time I was down south on firearms, and I was asked to I think I was a specialist firearms officer at the time, but I was asked to go on to armed response vehicles to backfill that, because some of those people had gone up to G8 to do close protection. And it was quite an interesting story that came out of Glen Eagles at the time. There was various pictures that were shown of Chinooks, the very large helicopters with the twin rotors for carrying large amounts of troops and things, on a couple of occasions when protesters caused problems in remote locations. They actually arranged for Met public order officers to be picked up by Chinook, by helicopter, and dropped off to deal with the sort of protesters. And a similar sort of story that I heard from some of my colleagues that went up from my force that I was in down south, They were on the close protection detail, and we've talked about close protection before in several episodes, but one of the things that happens on close protection is, you know, if you know you're going to a particular venue, let's say tomorrow, you would definitely drive the route the day before. So a lead element would drive that route and be completely familiar with everything about that route. And that's firstly so you don't get lost, because that would be incredibly embarrassing, but also so you get a feel for it and you see what's there, because the following day you will run that route again, maybe, you know, 10 minutes ahead of the main convoy. And if something's out of place, you'll immediately notice it. You know, if there was a transit van parked up at the side of the road that wasn't there yesterday, you'd definitely be wanting to investigate that, or maybe direct uniform colleagues to kind of investigate something like that, for example, you know, depending on and what it was. So you always run the routes probably a week before, maybe a day before, and then certainly on the day, kind of 10 minutes or half an hour before your convoy comes through. So you're very, very familiar with that route. The problem was in Scotland, and certainly the areas around Glen Eagles, you know, some of it's very rural, quite remote, difficult to get to. And obviously the officers I was talking about, my colleagues from down south, you know, did not know the local area at all, had no clue. Anyway, they found themselves at these big events, you'll find you have sort of massive eating areas. So there'll be huge, huge tents put up, marquees, and they'll be feeding, you know, 200, 300, 500 people a day with sort of basic food, basic rations, very much in a sort of military operation to keep people fed. And you can find yourself sitting alongside all sorts of interesting people from different places and different roles. And my colleagues on close protection found themselves sitting at the table with the pilots of a Chinook helicopter. I mean, as we already discussed, these large twin rotor helicopters. And, you know, they got chatting and sort of just over who did what, you know, and sort of what roles they both had. And one of my guys happened to mention that, well, we're just going out, you know, to drive a route for an advance tomorrow. That's what it's called, an advance. But we're not too sure we're going. It's quite remote. It's going to take a while, etc. And the pilot said, well, I'm about to, you know, we've got to go and do a familiarisation flight in the area. And we've also been asked to fly a very similar route to one of the ones you're taking. You know, why don't we combine the two, you know, jump on board and we can do it together. So, of course, you can imagine my colleagues' ears pricked up and they couldn't believe their luck. And, of course, they were trying not to sound like big, excited children at the fact that they were going to get a free ride in a helicopter, you know. But that's exactly what they did. So they actually must be some of the few cops to have actually, close protection cops, to have done an advance, you know, run this route via Chinook, you know. So it's there's some fantastic stories and pictures to tell and show when they got back, you know, that they'd managed to have this flying around in the Chinook. So it must have been very good, very interesting. And the other big one that I was involved in was in London, the 2012 Olympics. Now, that was a huge, huge job again for the Met. Absolutely massive. Once again, mutual aid, you know, lots of assistance from all sorts of other forces. People, you know, colleagues from abroad and all sorts came in various specialisms. Now, at the time, if you remember, I was on the dive team, which was also the underwater and confined spaces search team. So we did, you know, lots of things around that. And again, obviously, there's been lots of episodes around that. So you might wonder what sort of role we carried out. Well, lots of our work was carried out prior to the Olympics. So probably in about a 6-week lead up, something like that, we started our work. And one of our big roles was the athletes had individual accommodation built for them. So I think it was about 4 tower blocks that were built to house all the athletes when they came, you know, so they all had their own little flats or apartments within these buildings. Well, these were brand new buildings that went up, and as a result also had, you know, all the things that go along with large buildings. And by that I mean sewer systems and drainage, you know, and what have you, underground parking, you know, underneath the buildings for all the vehicles. So all of that had to be searched. Now, you might wonder why, because it's brand new, but the reality is, you imagine if you managed to infiltrate the building side of it with a dodgy builder who had a real issue against, you know, a particular country's, I don't know, running team or president, and wanted to, you know, make your presence known and strike, you know, strike for freedom if that's your thing, it wouldn't be a huge stretch to, you know, plant a device in one of those sewer areas or a drain or something like that on a timer, you know, to activate once the Olympics had actually started and opened, because that would be a huge coup for you and bring you all the publicity that you desire. So we actually had to go through and search all the sewers and the drain system. Now, it perhaps wasn't quite as bad as it sounds, because don't forget they were brand new, so they hadn't actually been used that much. We were used to doing this role, but normally on, you know, buildings that had been used for hundreds of years, so you can imagine how unpleasant that was. But we spent, you know, sort of 6 long weeks going through all these sewers one by one. I think underneath one building had something like 50 different sewers and drainage areas, and there was 4 buildings. So you can imagine the time that took. And then once they were searched, they get sealed with a special seal that can't be tampered with. And these seals are checked regularly by officers to make sure that they haven't been tampered with. So that was a huge role. And then when the actual Olympics started, pretty much our sort of dive team hats came back on, and anything that involved water would invariably have an element of us being there. So, for example, when there was a triathlon, they were doing their open water swim, and I think it was the Serpentine, one of the big sort of rivers and lakes that are around London and various locations. And we actually had one of our inflatable dinghies alongside the swimmers, with a couple of divers kitted up with fins in wetsuits ready to go should there be protesters that decide they're going to suddenly swim out, and again for the same reason try and disrupt and, you know, make you aware of their particular plight or cause, whatever it was. So we found ourselves at a lot of the sort of triathlons, and there was various open swimming events. There was also things that were happening on the Thames, the rowing, for example, you know, the speed rowing. So again, we had to have on the water security around those events, for exactly the same reason. And the same sort of thing that happens every year, for example, for the Cambridge-Oxford boat race. You know, there's always a lot of on the water security around that, some that you see and some that you don't. So they're the sort of things you get involved in. I thoroughly enjoyed the Olympics, actually. When it actually started, apart from the roles I've just talked about, a lot of the things, we were on standby, basically, to fill gaps. So again, if they suddenly found themselves lacking in whatever else it was, we went and sort of did that, you know. But the big events that you get involved in can be really quite interesting. But coming back to COP26, and I'd been asked to backfill, so I was back on response. And once again, you know, that is the sharp end, as we've talked about. And I found myself getting involved in several things. Now, when new probationers used to turn up at the police station I was working at, remember, it was, you know, a relatively small town on the west coast of Scotland, sometimes they're a bit disappointed at their at the actual posting they'd got, because all their friends have been ribbing them, you know, from Glasgow, saying that they're going to, you know, big bad Glasgow, and it's really busy and really scary, and they're going to get involved in all sorts of stuff, and you're going to be in Sleepy Hollow, and all you're going to deal with is sheep on the road and things, you know. But so sometimes they'll be a little bit disheartened when they came to us. But once they'd arrived, normally I would fill them full of a few stories, you know, some of the ones that I've told you. And you never found the variety anywhere else, I'd suggest, that you can get in, you know, those rural places. For sure, there was sheep on the road. You will deal with that. And there was a bit of that. But also, don't forget, you know, I've already told you the story about, you know, the yacht aground after the guy had said that he'd slit the throat of his crew and thrown him overboard. You know, it's not the sort of thing you find in, you know, sort of Glasgow Central. Also, I'll tell you another story now about a couple of colleagues went out to it. And again, imagine the variety this brings, albeit horrendous as it is. So a couple of friends of mine went out to a missing person. A woman had phoned up to report that her husband, you know, had gone out and she'd not seen him for a while. And then, you know, she was really getting worried the following day because he'd not left any notes or said he was going anywhere, just disappeared. So they'd gone round and, you know, thinking initially this is a standard sort of missing persons inquiry that happens a lot, and you obtain all the details you'd expect and a photo of them, ask them, you know, where are they likely to have gone, where are their phones. There's loads of inquiries you can do without even sort of leaving their house. But she said, look, I have no idea where he is at all. It's really strange, you know, it's totally out of character. She said the only thing he sort of particularly loves, his hobby, is kind of woodworking and generally tinkering in his man shed, you know, she called it. They had quite a large shed, which was very well equipped, you know, with all the tools and things that you would need for various, you know, hobbies. And lots of people, you know, male and female, like to get involved in fixing things, don't they, and tinkering, you know. So she said that was the last place I knew he was heading for. But she said, it's really strange. I've been out to have a look and it appears to be locked, but it's locked from the inside. So, of course, obviously alarm bells are ringing for the cops, and, you know, they can't now leave without having a look in this location. I've said before on missing persons, one of the very first things you have to do, particularly for children, is search that address as thoroughly as you can, because the amount of time kids have been reported missing when they're actually playing hide and seek with their brother or sister, you know, and they end up being hidden in some cupboard somewhere. And so you have to do that as a first stage. Anyway, the guys went out to the shed, and they, you know, like the wife, couldn't find a way in at all, had a look round, and it was a wooden shed, and it had, you know, sort of planking along the edges. One of those they noticed was a bit loose. In fact, there was two that were loose, but both the guys that had gone out, my colleagues, were very big guys, and by the time you put body armour on them as well, you know, they really are big guys. They managed to move a couple of these planks to give a little bit of access into the building, but not enough for them to get in. Now, the wife was quite slight, and she said, or they said, look, is there any chance you could get in there just to unlock the door from the inside? You know, could you fit through this gap? So she said, yeah, sure, you know, I'll get in, I'll go around, I'll unlock whatever, you know, lock the door on the inside and let you in. Seemed like a good idea at the time. And to be honest with you, you know, was the sort of solution that seems obvious. So wife slips through this gap into the shed, disappears off. And then the next thing the cops hear is this absolute blood-curdling scream from within, followed by, you know, sobbing, and this woman clearly, you know, having a complete meltdown, and not surprising why. Eventually they managed to convince her, because they couldn't even speak to her to start with, she was in such a state, they managed to convince her to go and unlock the door, you know, from the inside. So she went round and opened the padlock on the door and let the cops in, and then sort of basically fell outside onto the floor and was just, you know, in a big heap on the floor, very, very emotional. So the cops went in fearing what they were going to see, and to be honest with you, it pretty much couldn't have got any worse. This guy had committed suicide within the shed, but he'd done it with a chainsaw. And what he'd actually done was put the chainsaw into a vise, which obviously held the chainsaw very tight. And then he started the chainsaw, and then he taped the throttle open, wide open, so the chainsaw was running flat out. And then he basically headbutted the blade or the chain, you know, with his head as it's running full power, this chainsaw. That is the way he chose to commit suicide. Now, I have no idea what sort of place you have to be in to do that, and quite how he thought, you know, it would go for whoever found him, let alone if it was his wife. And I appreciate he'd locked the door from the inside. Anyway, it's a difficult one to figure out, and I mean, I'm sure you could talk about it for a while and try and get your head around it, but I'm not sure you ever would. Terrible, terrible way to go, and horrendous for the wife. You know, I mean, I don't think she'll ever get over that. But it does seem to be that males tend to commit suicide in the most terrible ways, or they can do. Women, it seems to be, generally take themselves off somewhere quiet, and, you know, take tablets or do something that's generally sort of quiet and peaceful. But men sometimes seem to have a, you know, in the most sort of violent, aggressive, explosive ways of doing it. But that's certainly my experience, and obviously not based on any, you know, studies or anything. It's just what I've found in my time in the police. So a terrible job, you know. But again, you know, when we're coming back to the new cops that have arrived, you know, who are saying, I'm just going to deal with, you know, sheep on the road. So, well, you know, in the one day, because that actually, that chainsaw suicide job came in the same day as yacht aground job. So I was saying, you know, in this one day, you could have been dealing with a yacht aground with this guy, you know, and all the story there, if you listen back to one of the previous episodes, and a chainsaw suicide. You know, it's not the sort of thing you're going to find in Glasgow Central. And I think within, you know, maybe 3 months, 6 months, they realised just the variety that, you know, that it could offer, you know, working in a sort of smaller rural area. Different challenges, you know, for sure. So anyway, coming back to me backfilling and some of the things I was getting involved in, I was out on patrol with one of my colleagues, and we were called to reports of a female trying to take her own life. So they gave the details of the female. Now, she was one of our regulars for sure. Now, I think I told you a few episodes back about another female who was a very much a regular for us, but this one was the same. A very likable woman, to be honest with you, but she'd had a real terrible, you know, things happen to her in her life. And one of the most recent ones was she'd finally found a partner, someone who she really loved and got on well with. She was a drug user and a drinker, and so was he. And they seemed very happy. I'd spoken to her a little while prior to that. And it all seemed to be going very well. And she's actually positive about the future, the first time I'd ever seen it. And then her new partner died. I can't remember if it was a drug overdose or whether it was through alcoholism, one of the two. But it completely destroyed her again and set her spiralling back into almost daily suicide attempts. A very, very sad case, really, for her. But on this occasion, we'd been called to her attempting to take her own life again. And when we turned up, she had a shoelace tied around her neck. Now, you might think that's easy to do, and she'd done this before, to be honest with you, and she'd put a sort of loose knot around her neck, but not, almost not really tried too hard. But on this occasion, she'd put like a slip knot on it that locked on itself, so she tightened it up around her neck, and then she genuinely couldn't get it off. I think the plan was that when we turned up, you know, and sort of there, she was getting some attention and some sort of contact, she was going to take this shoelace off. But the problem was it had now locked around her neck. So actually, when we turned up, she was flat on her back, very, very pale, already getting blue lips and, you know, sort of red cheeks. And she was desperately clawing away at this shoelace, trying to release herself, but she couldn't. Thankfully, we carry all the cars all have seatbelt cutters. Now, if you haven't got one for your car, I'd strongly suggest you get one. You can get a combined, I think it's called a safety hammer and a seatbelt cutter, which has a blade on it that you can just slip around a seatbelt and pull it and it cuts the seatbelt. And also the safety hammer enables you to smash a window. You know, if there's been an accident, either you need to get out or you need to get someone else out. A little tip from the top, if you ever have to smash a car window, hit it right in the corner. Don't ever try and hit it in the middle, because actually glass has a little bit of flex in it, and sometimes you can find yourself hitting repeatedly and not getting anywhere. Imagine how I know that story. But yeah, so hit on the edges and the window will go in a lot easier. So they're very good. So my colleague ran back to the car, grabbed the seatbelt cutter, and was able to cut the shoelace from around her neck carefully, I have to say, because they're so thin, we didn't want to also cut her throat, you know, while we were trying to release that. You can imagine how that would go. Mental health is a huge, huge part of policing now. When I first joined, you know, it was barely 10%, I'd say, and now it's probably something more like, I don't know, 85% maybe or something of police work, a huge amount, and they're constantly trying to revise how it's dealt with. Certainly in England and Wales, it's Section 136 of the Mental Health Act is your sort of emergency powers. And it's a different section because it's slightly different legislation in Scotland. But it effectively means the same thing. Police have the power, and this is the key point, if you're in a public place, to remove you for your own safety to a place of safety. Now, that generally is the hospital. It can be the police station at a push, but that isn't really the preferred choice and isn't really seen as the ideal location. At a push, you could take them to the NIC, but the reality is you're probably going to take them to the hospital and get them assessed. But the key there is they have to be in a public place. Now, the big problem I have had with it is I've gone around and dealt with people in their home addresses. And a classic example was in my first year or two when I was still a probationer, we were called to, it was a woman who'd said that she'd taken a load of pills and intended to take her life. And she was sitting in an address. Now, we went round there. The ambulance had gone as well and had been called to the location. And she very calmly told us, I've taken all these. She had them laid out in front of her, the packets, all these empty packets. I've taken these. I want to die. You know, and she went into the reasons for it. I can't remember what they were, to be honest with you. But she'd had enough and she decided that was it. But she didn't want to be left for days in her house, you know, dead and not found and family not know. So she'd called for someone to be there. Now, you might say it's a little bit unfair in some respects because she puts that on the ambulance crew and potentially on us as the police to sit there and watch her die. Now, of course, you think, well, why don't you just scoop her up and take her to the hospital? The problem is she's not in a public place. She's in her home address. So we had a conversation both with, you know, my sergeant and also the ambulance crew. And they were saying, well, we're not happy to physically drag her to the hospital. We don't really have the power. And at that point, within the home address, because it's not a public place, we also didn't really have the power. So the best solution we could come up to, ridiculous as it sounds, was waiting for her to pass out, become unconscious, which, of course, could be too late. but waiting for her to pass out so she could no longer sort of protest and tell us not to take her. Because at this point she was saying, I'm in the right state of mind that I don't want you to take me. You know, it's against my wishes, which causes issues. Potentially it's an assault to remove her. I know this might sound ridiculous to people, but that's kind of how it is. And certainly in the way of policing now, you do have to be incredibly careful how you go about things. So in the end, that's what we did. We just sat there with her quite calmly until she passed out. And the moment she was unconscious, we scooped her up into the ambulance and she was off away to the hospital. And I appreciate that if you made that power not without a public place, possibly it would be open to abuse. You know, you could literally scoop up anyone from anywhere and say, oh yeah, it's, you know, Section 136 of the Mental Health Act, you know. But so that public place thing has been put in for a reason. And another couple of occasions, I've had some of my frequent flyers, if you were, that were regulars calling about mental health, that would always be in their home addresses knowing they couldn't be taken anywhere. But a couple of times would try the same sort of thing when I found them on the street, not realising the difference between the legislation. So the moment that they... I found them on the street and they started saying, I've taken this and I'm going to kill myself and what have you. There's nothing you can do about it. It was almost like they were kind of goading me and wanting to, you know, sort of play a game. I said, well, I'm going to take you to hospital, you know, Section 136 or the other one in Scotland and prevent that. You know, I'm going to get you assessed. Of course, they were like, we can't do that. I know you can't do that. But they didn't realise the difference between this public place. So that's exactly what happened. You know, they would be scooped and run, as it were. I'm just going to finish, if the rain allows me, because it has just started to rain, with one more story, if I can. And that is, while I was backfilling on COP26 and I was on response, I was working with a young probationer, and we got called to an address of a guy, or sorry, it was a woman that had some issues with one of our well-known local sort of drunk, violent fighter types that was a pain in the butt in the town and we would deal with quite regularly. He also was, you know, into sort of domestic violence. He had various string of sort of girlfriends, all of whom he seemed to assault at various times. And that was no different from the address we'd been called to on this occasion. He actually had bail conditions not to approach her because he'd assaulted her in the past. But unfortunately, she was infatuated with him and kept sort of ringing him up and sort of inviting him round, even though it breached his conditions, which made him arrestable. Well, on this occasion, we got wind that he had gone to this address again. So we went to that location to try and arrest him, knowing that he was seeing her and breaching these bail conditions. So I think two or three of us ended up going in through the front door. And one of the guys, this young probationer, went round to the back. We went in through the front and the girl, of course, you know, said, oh, no, I've not seen him. You know, I know he's got bail conditions. He can't be here. So he's definitely not allowed to be here. No, I've never seen him at all. At which point we hear this high pitched sort of scream stroke shout from the back garden where this one other young probationer has gone. And we go running through the house and get out there to find this male, very strange scene, find this male standing in the back garden, wearing just a pair of boxer shorts, which are now pulled down around his knees, so he's effectively naked, and he is bleeding profusely from one of his buttocks, one of his butt cheeks. And the young probationer is kind of standing there, wide-eyed, kind of looking at us almost with his hands spread, saying, I'm not really sure what happened, you know. We're going, what did you do? I mean, we're winding up. We're going, what did you do? We only left you for 5 minutes, and now we come out and we find this guy bleeding from his butt, you know, and he's naked. What is going on? And this guy never lived it down. The cop, you know, obviously he got loads of wind-ups from us constantly about it, about, you know, if you leave him alone, what happens? What actually happened was the guy had been in the address and no doubt he was stripped off because him and this female were going to get intimate. When he knew the police were at the front door, he decided he was going to run out the back door, which, of course, is why we'd sent my colleague round there. So he was just wearing his boxers. Now, he'd crawled out through the back garden and underneath a hedge, which had quite a sharp fence on it. Some of that had cut his back. And when he then, as he sort of climbed out from underneath the fence to make good his escape, he was faced with a young probationer who grabbed hold of him and said, look, stay here. My colleagues are just coming. Sit down over there and just wait, you know. And he was kind of going to wait for backup before he then cuffed him, because this guy was quite big and violent. So this guy was just sat in his boxers, moves across and goes to sit down with all his weight on this, I think it was like a wooden seat or something that was in this back garden. What he didn't know was there was a very large nail that was sticking straight up out of this seat. So when he sat down with all his weight, he basically pierced his buttock with this nasty, rusty nail, which then caused him to bleed a lot. And when we came round, he pulled his boxer shorts down to actually look at the bleeding and sort of see the injury he'd done to himself. So it was easily explained, albeit, as I say, my poor young colleague was a bit appalled by what had happened, but it was all's well that ends well, and it was a good bit of fun and an opportunity for some banter and a wind-up. So I think we got away with it. Apologies for the sound. I know for a fact that there's been some cars going past. You might have heard a bit of the rain in the background. But as I say, this was the third attempt. This was my last option, as it's now Thursday morning. So the podcast goes out tomorrow. But we got through it. And I'll speak to you again next week. We'll have some more stories for you. Thanks very much. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.